the land. He should have taken Ted Kahn more seriously. Dave? He said slowly. Is that really you? Who else could it be? A part of his mind asked. Yet it was not a foolish question. There was something curiously mechanical, impersonal, about the voice that came from the small speaker on Falcon's control board. Yes, Frank. I am Dave. There was a very brief pause. Then the same voice continued, without any change of intonation. Hello, Frank. This is Hal. Miss Pringle, record. Well, Indra? Dim? I'm glad I recorded all that, otherwise you'd never believe me. I guess I'm still in a state of shock. First of all, how should I feel about someone who tried to, who did, kill me, even if it was 1,000 years ago? But I understand now that Hal wasn't to blame. Nobody was. There's a very good piece of advice I've often found useful. Never attribute to malevolence what is merely due to incompetence. I can't feel any anger towards a bunch of programmers I never knew, who've been dead for centuries. I'm glad this is encrypted, as I don't know how it should be handled, and a lot that I tell you may turn out to be complete nonsense. I'm already suffering from information overload, and had to ask Dave to leave me for a while, after all the trouble I've gone through to meet him. But I don't think I hurt his feelings. I'm not sure yet if he has any feelings. What is he? Good question. Well, he really is Dave Bowman, but with most of the humanity stripped away. Like the synopsis of a book or a technical paper. You know how an abstract can give all the basic information but no hint of the author's personality? Yet there were moments when I felt that something of the old Dave was still there. I wouldn't go so far as to say he's pleased to meet me again. Moderately satisfied might be more like it. For myself, I'm still very confused. Like meeting an old friend after a long separation and finding that they're now a different person. Well, it has been 1,000 years. And I can't imagine what experiences he's known, though, as I'll show you presently, he's tried to share some of them with me. And Hal. He's here, too, without question. Most of the time, there's no way I can tell which of them is speaking to me. Aren't there examples of multiple personalities in the medical records? Maybe it's something like that. I asked him how this had happened to them both, and damn it. Halman tried to explain. Let me repeat. I may have got it partly wrong, but it's the only working hypothesis I have. Of course, the monolith, in its various manifestations, is the key. No, that's the wrong word. Didn't someone once say it was a kind of cosmic Swiss Army knife? You still have them, I've noticed. Though both Switzerland and its army disappeared centuries ago, it's a general-purpose device that can do anything it wants to, or was programmed to do. Back in Africa, 4 million years ago, it gave us that evolutionary kick in the pants, for better or for worse. Then its sibling on the moon waited for us to climb out of the cradle. That we've already guessed, and Dave's confirmed it. I said that he doesn't have many human feelings, but he still has curiosity. He wants to learn. And what an opportunity he's had. When the Jupiter monolith absorbed him, can't think of a better word, it got more than it bargained for. Though it used him, apparently as a captured specimen, and a probe to investigate Earth, he's also been using it. With Hal's assistance, and who should understand a supercomputer better than another one, he's been exploring its memory and trying to find its purpose. Now, this is something that's very hard to believe. The monolith is a fantastically powerful machine. Look what it did to Jupiter. But it's no more than that. It's running on automatic. It has no consciousness. I remember once thinking that I might have to kick the Great Wall and shout, "Is there anyone there?" And the correct answer would have to be, "No one except Dave and Hal." Worse still, some of its systems may have started to fail. Dave even suggests that in a fundamental way it's become stupid. Perhaps it's been left on its own for too long. It's time for a service check. And he believes the monolith has made at least one misjudgment. Perhaps that's not the right word. It may have been deliberate, carefully considered. In any event, it's, well, truly awesome and terrifying in its implications. Luckily, I can show it to you so you can decide for yourselves. Yes, even though it happened 1,000 years ago, when Leonov flew the second mission to Jupiter, and all this time no one has ever guessed. I'm certainly glad you got me fitted with the brain cap. Of course, it's been invaluable. I can't imagine life without it. But now it's doing a job it was never designed for, and doing it remarkably well. It took Halman about 10 minutes to find how it worked, and to set up an interface. Now we have mind-to-mind contact, which is quite a strain on me, I can tell you. I have to keep asking them to slow down and use baby talk. Or should I say, baby think. I'm not sure how well this will come through. It's 1,000-year-old recording of Dave's own experience, somehow stored in the monolith's enormous memory, then retrieved by Dave and injected into my brain cap, don't ask me exactly how, and finally transferred and beamed to you by Ganymede Central. Phew! Hope you don't get a headache downloading it. Over to Dave Bowman at Jupiter. Early 21st century. Chapter 30. Foamscape. The million-kilometer-long tendrils of magnetic force, the sudden explosion of radio waves, the geysers of electrified plasma wider than the planet Earth, they were as real and clearly visible to him as the clouds banding the planet in multi-hued glory. He could understand the complex pattern of their interactions and realize that Jupiter was much more wonderful than anyone had ever guessed. Even as he fell through the roaring heart of the great red spot, with the lightning of its continent-wide thunderstorms detonating under him, he knew why it had persisted for centuries, though it was made of gases far less substantial than those that formed the hurricanes of Earth. The thin scream of hydrogen wind faded as he sank into the calmer depths, and a sheet of waxen snowflakes, some already coalescing into barely palpable mountains of hydrocarbon foam, descended from the heights above. It was already warm enough for liquid water to exist, but there were no oceans there. This purely gaseous environment was too tenuous to support them. He descended through layer after layer of cloud, until he entered a region of such clarity that even human vision could have scanned an area more than 1,000 kilometers across. It was only a minor eddy in the vaster gyre of the great red spot, and it held a secret that men had long guessed but never proved. Skirting the foothills of the drifting foam mountains were myriad of small, sharply defined clouds, all about the same size and patterned with similar red and brown mottling. They were small only as compared with the inhuman scale of their surroundings. The very least would have covered a fair-sized city. They were clearly alive, for they were moving with slow deliberation along the flanks of the aerial mountains, browsing off their slopes like colossal sheep. And they were calling to each other in the meter band, their radio voices faint but clear against the cracklings and concussions of Jupiter itself. Nothing less than living gas bags, they floated in the narrow zone between freezing heights and scorching depths. Narrow, yes, but a domain far larger than all the biosphere of Earth. They were not alone. Moving swiftly among them were other creatures, so small that they could easily have been overlooked. Some of them bore an almost uncanny resemblance to terrestrial aircraft, and were of about the same size, but they too were alive. Perhaps predators? Perhaps parasites? Perhaps even herdsmen? A whole new chapter of evolution, as alien as that which he had glimpsed on Europa, was opening before him. There were jet-propelled torpedoes, like the squids of the terrestrial oceans, hunting and devouring the huge gas bags. But the balloons were not defenseless. Some of them fought back with electric thunderbolts and with clawed tentacles like kilometer-long chainsaws. There were even stranger shapes, exploiting almost every possibility of geometry. Bizarre, translucent kites, tetrahedra, spheres, polyhedra, tangles of twisted ribbons. The gigantic plankton of the Jovian atmosphere, they were designed to float like gossamer in the uprising currents until they had lived long enough to reproduce. Then they would be swept down into the depths to be carbonized and recycled in a new generation. He was searching a world more than 100 times the area of Earth, and though he saw many wonders, nothing there hinted of intelligence. The radio voices of the great balloons carried only simple messages of warning or of fear. Even the hunters, who might have been expected to develop higher degrees of organization, were like the sharks in Earth's oceans, mindless automata. And for all its breathtaking size and novelty, the biosphere of Jupiter was a fragile world, a place of mists and foam, of delicate silken threads and paper-thin tissues spun from the continual snowfall of petrochemicals borne by lightning in the upper atmosphere. Few of its constructs were more substantial than soap bubbles. Its most awesome predators could be torn to shreds by even the feeblest of terrestrial carnivores. Like Europa, but on a vastly grander scale, Jupiter was an evolutionary cul-de-sac. Intelligence would never emerge here. Even if it did, it would be doomed to a stunted existence. A purely aerial culture might develop, but in an environment where fire was impossible and solids scarcely existed, it could never even reach the Stone Age. Chapter 31. Nursery. Miss Pringle. Record. Well, Indra, Dim, I hope that came through in good shape. I still find it hard to believe. All those fantastic creatures. Surely we should have detected their radio voices, even if we couldn't understand them. Wiped out in a moment, so that Jupiter could be made into a sun. And now we can understand why. It was to give the Europs their chance. What pitiless logic. Is intelligence the only thing that matters? I can see some long arguments with Ted Kahn over this. The next question is, will the Europs make the grade, or will they remain forever stuck in the kindergarten? Not even that, the nursery. Though 1,000 years is a very short time, one would have expected some progress. But according to Dave, they're exactly the same now as when they left the sea. Perhaps that's the trouble. They still have 1 foot, or 1 twig, in the water. And here's another thing we got completely wrong. We thought they went back into the water to sleep. It's just the other way around. They go back to eat and sleep when they come on land. As we might have guessed from their structure, that network of branches, they're plankton feeders. I asked Dave about the igloos they've built. Aren't they a technological advance? And he said, not really. They're only adaptations of structures they make on the seabed to protect themselves from various predators, especially something like a flying carpet as big as a football field. There's one area, though, where they have shown initiative, even creativity. They're fascinated by metals, presumably because they don't exist in pure form in the ocean. That's why Tian was stripped. The same things happen to the occasional probes that have come down in their territory. What do they do with the copper and beryllium and titanium they collect? Nothing useful, I'm afraid. They pile it all together in one place, in a fantastic heap that they keep reassembling. They could be developing an aesthetic sense, I've seen worse in the Museum of Modern Art, but I've got another theory. Did you ever hear of cargo cults? During the 20th century, some of the few primitive tribes that still existed made imitation aeroplanes out of bamboo in the hope of attracting the big birds in the sky that occasionally brought them wonderful gifts. Perhaps the Europs have the same idea. Now, that question you keep asking me, what is Dave, and how did he and Hal become whatever it is they are now? The quick answer, of course, is that they're both emulations, simulations, in the monolith's gigantic memory. Most of the time, they're inactivated. When I asked Dave about this, he said he'd been awake, his actual word, for only 50 years altogether, in the thousands since his, metamorphosis. When I asked if he resented this takeover of his life, he said, "Why should I resent it? I am performing my functions perfectly." Yes, that sounds exactly like Hal, but I believe it was Dave, if there's any distinction now. Remember that Swiss Army knife analogy? Halman is one of this cosmic knife's myriad of components. But he's not a completely passive tool. When he's awake, he has some autonomy, some independence. Presumably within limits set by the monolith's overriding control. During the centuries, he's been used as a kind of intelligent probe to examine Jupiter, as you've just seen, as well as Ganymede and the Earth. That confirms those mysterious events in Florida, reported by Dave's old girlfriend, and the nurse who was looking after his mother just moments before her death, as well as the encounters in Anubis City. And it also explains another mystery. I asked Dave directly, why was I allowed to land on Europa when everyone else has been turned away for centuries? I fully expected to be. The answer was ridiculously simple. The monolith uses Dave, Halman, from time to time to keep an eye on us. Dave knew all about my rescue. Even saw some of the media interviews I made on Earth and on Ganymede. I must say I'm still a little hurt he made no attempt to contact me. But at least he put out the welcome mat when I did arrive. Dim, I still have 48 hours before Falcon leaves, with or without me. I don't think I'll need them, now I've made contact with Halman. We can keep in touch just as easily from Anubis. If he wants to do so. And I'm anxious to get back to the Granny Mead as quickly as possible. Falcon's a fine little spacecraft, but her plumbing could be improved. It's beginning to smell in here, and I'm itching for a shower. Look forward to seeing you, and especially Ted Kahn. We have much to talk about before I return to Earth. Transmit. Store. Part 5. Termination. The toil of all that be heals not the primal fault. It rains into the sea, and still the sea is salt. A. E. Houseman. More poems. Chapter 32. A Gentleman of Leisure. On the whole, it had been an interesting but uneventful 3 decades, punctuated by the joys and sorrows which time and fate bring to all mankind. The greatest of those joys had been wholly unexpected. In fact, before he left Earth for Ganymede, Poole would have dismissed the very idea as preposterous. There is much truth in the saying that absence makes the heart grow fonder. When he and Indra Wallace met again, they discovered that, despite their bantering and occasional disagreements, they were closer than they had imagined. One thing led to another, including, to their mutual joy, Don Wallace and Martin Poole. It was rather late in life to start a family, quite apart from that little matter of 1,000 years, and Professor Anderson had warned them that it might be impossible, or even worse. "You were lucky in more ways than you realize," he told Poole, Radiation damage was surprisingly low, and we were able to make all necessary repairs from your intact DNA. But until we do some more tests, I can't promise genetic integrity. So, enjoy yourselves, but don't start a family until I give the okay. The tests had been time-consuming, and as Anderson had feared, further repairs were necessary. There was one major setback, something that could never have lived, even if it had been allowed to go beyond the first few weeks after conception. But Martin and Dawn were perfect, with just the right number of heads, arms, and legs. They were also handsome and intelligent, and barely managed to escape being spoiled by their doting parents, who continued to be the best of friends when, after 15 years, each opted for independence again. Because of their social achievement rating, they would have been permitted, indeed encouraged, to have another child, but they decided not to put any more of a burden on their astonishingly good luck. One tragedy had shadowed Poole's personal life during this period, and indeed had shocked the whole solar community. Captain Chandler and his entire crew had been lost when the nucleus of a comet they were reconnoitering exploded suddenly, destroying Goliath so completely that only a few fragments were ever located. Such explosions, caused by reactions among unstable molecules which existed at very low temperatures, were a well-known danger to comet collectors, and Chandler had encountered several during his career. No one would ever know the exact circumstances which caused so experienced a spaceman to be taken by surprise. Poole missed Chandler very badly. He had played a unique role in his life, and there was no one to replace him. No one except Dave Bowman, with whom he had shared so momentous an adventure. He and Chandler had often made plans to go into space together again, perhaps all the way out to the Oort cloud with its unknown mysteries and its remote but inexhaustible wealth of ice. Yet some conflict of schedules had always upset their plans, so this was a wished-for future that would never exist. Another long-desired goal Poole had managed to achieve, despite Doctor's orders. He had been down to Earth, and once was quite enough. The vehicle in which he had traveled looked almost identical to the wheelchairs used by the luckier paraplegics of his own time. It was motorized, and had balloon tires which allowed it to roll over reasonably smooth surfaces. However, it could also fly, at an altitude of about 20 centimeters, on an air cushion produced by a set of small but very powerful fans. Poole was surprised that so primitive a technology was still in use, but inertia control devices were too bulky for such small-scale applications. Seated comfortably in his hover chair, he was scarcely conscious of his increasing weight as he descended into the heart of Africa. Though he did notice some difficulty in breathing, he had experienced far worse during his astronaut training. What he was not prepared for was the blast of furnace heat that smote him as he rolled out of the gigantic, sky-piercing cylinder that had formed the base of the tower. Yet it was still morning. What would it be like at noon? He had barely accustomed himself to the heat when his sense of smell was assailed. A myriad odors, none unpleasant but all unfamiliar, clamored for his attention. He closed his eyes for a few minutes, in an attempt to avoid overloading his input circuits. Before he had decided to open them again, he felt some large, moist object palpating the back of his neck. "Say hello to Elizabeth," said his guide, a burly young man dressed in traditional great white hunter garb, much too smart to have seen any real use. "She's our official greeter." Poole twisted round in his chair, and found himself looking into the soulful eyes of a baby elephant. "Hello, Elizabeth," he answered rather feebly. Elizabeth lifted her trunk in salute, and emitted a sound not usually heard in polite society, though Poole felt sure it was well-intentioned. Altogether, he spent less than an hour on planet Earth, skirting the edge of a jungle whose stunted trees compared unfavorably with skylands, and encountering much of the local fauna. His guides apologized for the friendliness of the lions, who had been spoilt by tourists, but the malevolent expression of the crocodiles more than compensated. Here was nature raw and unchanged. Before he returned to the tower, Poole risked taking a few steps away from his hover chair. He realized that this would be the equivalent of carrying his own weight on his back, but that did not seem an impossible feat, and he would never forgive himself unless he attempted it. It was not a good idea. Perhaps he should have tried it in a cooler climate. After no more than a dozen steps, he was glad to sink back into the luxurious clutches of the chair. "That's enough," he said wearily. "Let's go back to the tower." As he rolled into the elevator lobby, he noticed a sign which he had somehow overlooked during the excitement of his arrival. It read, "Welcome to Africa. In wildness is the preservation of the world. Henry David Thoreau, 1817 to 1862. Observing Poole's interest, the guide asked, "Did you know him?" It was the sort of question Poole heard all too often, and at the moment he did not feel equipped to deal with it. "I don't think so," he answered wearily, as the great doors closed behind them, shutting out the sights, scents, and sounds of mankind's earliest home. His vertical safari had satisfied his need to visit Earth, and he did his best to ignore the various aches and pains acquired there when he returned to his apartment at level 10,000, a prestigious location, even in this democratic society. Indra, however, was mildly shocked by his appearance, and ordered him straight to bed. "Just like Antaeus, but in reverse," she muttered darkly. "Who?" asked Poole. There were times when his wife's erudition was a little overwhelming, but he had determined never to let it give him an inferiority complex. "Son of the earth goddess Gaia. Hercules wrestled with him, but every time he was thrown to the ground, Antaeus renewed his strength."
"Who won?"
"Hercules, of course, by holding Antaeus in the air so Ma couldn't recharge his batteries."
"Well, I'm sure it won't take me long to recharge mine. And I've learned one lesson. If I don't get more exercise, I may have to move up to lunar gravity level."
Poole's good resolution lasted a full month. Every morning he went for a brisk 5-kilometer walk, choosing a different level of the Africa Tower each day. Some floors were still vast, echoing deserts of metal, which would probably never be occupied. But others had been landscaped and developed over the centuries in a bewildering variety of architectural styles. Many were borrowings from past ages and cultures. Others hinted at futures which Poole would not care to visit. At least there was no danger of boredom. And on many of his walks he was accompanied at a respectful distance by small groups of friendly children. They were seldom able to keep up with him for long. One day, as Poole was striding down a convincing, though sparsely populated, imitation of the Champs-Élysées, he suddenly spotted a familiar face.
"Daniel!" he called.
The other man took not the slightest notice, even when Poole called again more loudly.
"Don't you remember me?"
Daniel. And now that he had caught up with him, Poole did not have the slightest doubt of his identity, looked genuinely baffled.
"I'm sorry," he said. "You're Commander Poole, of course, but I'm sure we've never met before."
Now it was Poole's turn to be embarrassed. "Stupid of me," he apologized. "Must have mistaken you for someone else. Have a good day." He was glad of the encounter, and was pleased to know that Daniel was back in normal society. Whether his original crime had been axe murders or overdue library books should no longer be the concern of his one-time employer. The account had been settled, the books closed. Although Poole sometimes missed the cops and robbers dramas he had often enjoyed in his youth, he had grown to accept the current wisdom. Excessive interest in pathological behavior was itself pathological. With the help of Miss Pringle, Mark III, Poole had been able to schedule his life so that there were even occasional blank moments when he could relax and set his brain cap on random search, scanning his areas of interest. Outside his immediate family, his chief concerns were still among the moons of Jupiter, stroke Lucifer, not least because he was recognized as the leading expert on the subject and a permanent member of the Europa Committee. This had been set up almost 1,000 years ago to consider what, if anything, could and should be done about the mysterious satellite. Over the centuries, it had accumulated a vast amount of information, going all the way back to the Voyager flybys of 1979 and the first detailed surveys from the orbiting Galileo spacecraft of 1996. Like most long-lived organizations, the Europa Committee had become slowly fossilized, and now met only when there was some new development. It had woken up with a start after Hallmann's reappearance and appointed an energetic new chairperson, whose first act had been to co-opt Poole. Though there was little that he could contribute that was not already recorded, Poole was very happy to be on the committee. It was obviously his duty to make himself available, and it also gave him an official position he would otherwise have lacked. Previously, his status was what had once been called a national treasure, which he had found faintly embarrassing. Although he was glad to be supported in luxury by a world wealthier than all the dreams of war-ravaged earlier ages could have imagined, he felt the need to justify his existence. He also felt another need, which he seldom articulated even to himself. Hallmann had spoken to him, if only briefly, at their strange encounter 2 decades ago. Poole was certain that, if he wished, Hallmann could easily do so again. Were all human contacts no longer of interest to him? He hoped that was not the case, yet that might be one explanation of his silence. He was frequently in touch with Theodore Kahn, as active and acerbic as ever, and now the Europa Committee's representative on Ganymede. Ever since Poole had returned to Earth, Ted had been trying in vain to open a channel of communication with Bowman. He could not understand why long lists of important questions on subjects of vital philosophical and historic interest received not even brief acknowledgments.
"Does the monolith keep your friend Hallmann so busy that he can't talk to me?" he complained to Poole. "What does he do with his time, anyway?"
It was a very reasonable question, and the answer came, like a thunderbolt out of a cloudless sky, from Bowman himself, as a perfectly commonplace vidphone call. Chapter 33. Contact.
"Hello, Frank. This is Dave. I have a very important message for you. I assume that you are now in your suite in Africa Tower. If you are there, please identify yourself by giving the name of our instructor in orbital mechanics. I will wait for 60 seconds, and if there is no reply, we'll try again in exactly 1 hour." That minute was hardly long enough for Poole to recover from the shock. He felt a brief surge of delight, as well as astonishment, before another emotion took over. Glad though he was to hear from Bowman again, that phrase, "a very important message," sounded distinctly ominous. At least it was fortunate, Poole told himself, that he's asked for one of the few names I can remember. Yet who could forget a Scot with a Glasgow accent so thick it had taken them a week to master it? But he had been a brilliant lecturer, once you understood what he was saying.
"Dr. Gregory McVitie."
"Accepted. Now please switch on your brain cap receiver. It will take 3 minutes to download this message. Do not attempt to monitor. I am using 10-to-1 compression. I will wait 2 minutes before starting."
How was he managing to do this?
Poole wondered. Jupiter, Lucifer, was now over 50 light minutes away, so this message must have left almost an hour ago. It must have been sent with an intelligent agent in a properly addressed package on the Ganymede Earth beam. But that would have been a trivial feat to Halman, with the resources he had apparently been able to tap inside the monolith. The indicator light on the brain box was flickering. The message was coming through. At the compression Halman was using, it would take half an hour for Poole to absorb the message in real time, but he needed only 10 minutes to know that his peaceful lifestyle had come to an abrupt end. Chapter 34. Judgment. In a world of universal and instantaneous communication, it was very difficult to keep secrets. This was a matter, Poole decided immediately, for face-to-face discussion. The Europa Committee had grumbled, but all its members had assembled in his apartment. There were 7 of them, the lucky number, doubtless suggested by the phases of the moon that had always fascinated mankind. It was the first time Poole had met 3 of the committee's members, though by now he knew them all more thoroughly than he could possibly have done in a pre-brain-capped lifetime. Chairperson O'Connor, members of the committee, I'd like to say a few words, only a few, I promise, before you download the message I've received from Europa. And this is something I prefer to do verbally, and that's more natural for me. I'm afraid I'll never be quite at ease with direct mental transfer. As you all know, Dave Bowman and Hal have been stored as emulations in the monolith on Europa. Apparently, it never discards a tool it once found useful, and from time to time it activates Halman to monitor our affairs when they begin to concern it. As I suspect my arrival may have done, though perhaps I flatter myself. But Halman isn't just a passive tool. The Dave component still retains something of its human origins, even emotions. And because we were trained together, shared almost everything for years, he apparently finds it much easier to communicate with me than with anyone else. I would like to think he enjoys doing it, but perhaps that's too strong a word. He's also curious, inquisitive, and perhaps a little resentful of the way he's been collected like a specimen of wildlife, though that's probably what we are from the viewpoint of the intelligence that created the monolith. And where is that intelligence now? Halman apparently knows the answer. And it's a chilling one. As we always suspected, the monolith is part of a galactic network of some kind. And the nearest node, the monolith's controller, or immediate superior, is 450 light-years away. Much too close for comfort. This means that the report on us and our affairs that was transmitted early in the 21st century was received half a millennium ago. If the monolith's, let's say, supervisor, replied at once, any further instructions should be arriving just about now. And that's exactly what seems to be happening. During the last few days, the monolith has been receiving a continuous string of messages and has been setting up new programs, presumably in accordance with these. Unfortunately, Halman can only make guesses about the nature of those instructions. As you'll gather when you've downloaded this tablet, he has some limited access to many of the monolith's circuits and memory banks, and can even carry on a dialogue with it. If that's the right word, since you need 2 people for that. I still can't really grasp the idea that the monolith, for all its powers, doesn't possess consciousness, doesn't even know that it exists. Halman's been brooding over the problem for 1,000 years on and off, and has come to the same answer that most of us have done. But his conclusion must surely carry far more weight, because of his inside knowledge. Sorry, I wasn't intending to make a joke, but what else could you call it?
Whatever went to the trouble of creating us, or at least tinkering with our ancestors' minds and genes, is deciding what to do next. And Halman is pessimistic. No, that's an exaggeration. Let's say he doesn't think much of our chances, but is now too detached an observer to be unduly worried. The future, the survival of the human race, isn't much more than an interesting problem to him, but he's willing to help. Poole suddenly stopped talking, to the surprise of his intent audience. That's strange. I've just had an amazing flashback. I'm sure it explains what's happening. Please bear with me. Dave and I were walking together one day, along the beach at the Cape, a few weeks before launch, when we noticed a large beetle lying on the sand. As often happens, it had fallen on its back and was waving its legs in the air, struggling to get right way up. I ignored it. We were engaged in some complicated technical discussion, but not Dave. He stepped aside and carefully flipped it over with his shoe. As it flew away, I commented, "Are you sure that was a good idea? Now it will go off and chomp somebody's prized chrysanthemums." And he answered, "Maybe you're right, but I'd like to give it the benefit of the doubt." My apologies. I'd promised to say only a few words, but I'm very glad I remembered that incident. I really believe it puts Halman's message in the right perspective. He's giving the human race the benefit of the doubt. Now, please check your brain caps. This is a high-density recording, top of the UV band, channel 110. Make yourselves comfortable, but be sure you're in line of sight. Here we go. Chapter 35. Council of War. No one asked for a replay. Once was sufficient. There was a brief silence when the playback finished. Then Chairperson Dr. O'Connor removed her brain cap, massaged her shining scalp, and said slowly, "You taught me a phrase from your period that seems very appropriate now. This is a can of worms."
"But only Bowman, Halman, has opened it," said one of the committee members. "Does he really understand the operation of something as complex as the monolith, or is this whole scenario a figment of his imagination?"
"I don't think he has much imagination," Dr. O'Connor answered, "and everything checks perfectly, especially the reference to Nova Scorpio. We assumed that was an accident. Apparently, it was a judgment."
"First Jupiter, now Scorpio," said Dr. Krausman, the distinguished physicist who was popularly regarded as a reincarnation of the legendary Einstein. A little plastic surgery, it was rumored, had also helped. "Who will be next in line?"
"We always guessed," said the chair, "that the TMAs were monitoring us." She paused for a moment, then added ruefully, "What bad, what incredibly bad luck that the final report went off just after the very worst period in human history." There was another silence. Everyone knew that the 20th century had often been branded the century of torture. Poole listened without interrupting while he waited for some consensus to emerge. Not for the first time, he was impressed by the quality of the committee. No one was trying to prove a pet theory, score debating points, or inflate an ego. He could not help drawing a contrast with the often bad-tempered arguments he had heard in his own time between space agency engineers and administrators, congressional staffs, and industrial executives. Yes, the human race had undoubtedly improved. The brain cap had not only helped to weed out misfits, but had enormously increased the efficiency of education. Yet there had also been a loss. There were very few memorable characters in this society. Offhand, he could think of only four,
Indra, Captain Chandler, Dr. Khan, and the Dragon Lady of Wistful Memory. The chairperson let the discussion flow smoothly back and forth until everyone had had a say, then began her summing up. The obvious first question, how seriously should we take this threat, isn't worth wasting time on. Even if it's a false alarm or a misunderstanding, it's potentially so grave that we must assume it's real until we have absolute proof to the contrary. Agreed? Good. And we don't know how much time we have, so we must assume that the danger is immediate. Perhaps Halman may be able to give us some further warning, but by then it may be too late. So the first thing we have to decide is, how can we protect ourselves against something as powerful as the monolith? Look what happened to Jupiter. And apparently, Nova Scorpio. I'm sure that brute force would be useless, though perhaps we should explore that option. Dr. Krausman, how long would it take to build a superbomb?
Assuming that the designs still exist, so that no research is necessary, perhaps 2 weeks. Thermonuclear weapons are rather simple and use common materials. After all, they made them back in the second millennium. But if you wanted...